Of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive, so now is a great time to join. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
Listeners, sponsored stations count on you, not Arbitron. So when you push their buttons, you get radio that turns you on.
Hi there, this is Ann Feeney, and you are listening to listener-supported community radio, KBOO FM in Portland.
Journey through lush songs and soundscapes, teeming with life, during the Garden of the Heart. Each episode explores the ways that music carries our emotions. Explore the garden every second Friday of the month from 8 to 10 p.m. The Garden of the Heart is a bilingual program in English and Spanish that offers a mix of music that spans multiple genres, languages, and styles. The host is Zoe Carrillo.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Birdie. It's been over 2 years since Russia invaded Ukraine in February of 2022. At various stages of the Russia-Ukraine war, some have wondered whether there was any possibility of negotiations that would lead to a political settlement. Pat Willerton is a professor of political science at the University of Arizona. He spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg.
This war has been going on for quite a while. Occasionally, we hear about negotiations between the two sides. And what's going on there? Is there a possibility of negotiations leading to a solution from what you've seen recently?
No. The Russians are basically winning. Essentially, they're accomplishing their goals. They're not going to negotiate other than surrender. It looks to me with the retirement or the pushing out of Victoria Nuland, who was the top government official who was responsible for the Ukraine area since 2014, that the United States has essentially determined the Project Ukraine is going down and we're now going to carefully walk away. So Russia is going to achieve its goals. I don't know how long this will go on. They have not operated the way I might have predicted. I'm not a specialist in military matters. I thought this would have been over a long time ago. It was never a stalemate. The Russians have always been completely in control of the situation. They chose to pursue this with one arm tied behind their back. The other hand had a glove on it. We see in Gaza more people have been killed in 4 or 5 months than have died in this war in over 2 years. So they proceeded carefully. They tried to avoid killing a lot of people. Both sides, I think, preferred not to kill civilians. But basically, Kiev regime has run out. They're running out of men. They're running out of ammunition. They're running out of equipment. They're simply slowly collapsing. And the Russians are now essentially a steamroller. They're very slowly grinding their way westward. And I don't think anybody knows how far they're going to go or how this will end, but I would say they are going to achieve their goals. Ukraine is not going to be in NATO. It will be demilitarized. They're basically destroying all of the military capability. You know, right now we're debating whether to send them $61 billion. I think in the end we will, because it's in the interest of most members of Congress, because of the $61 billion, about 40 will stay here and will go to Lockheed, Raytheon. We have Raytheon here in Tucson. We love Raytheon. We want that money. Raytheon is just they're just making profits head over heels. My wife works with some people there. They're hiring. They're doing great. Raytheon is doing great. It's great for the economy. And that's what's happening in many parts of the United States. So we're going to ultimately approve the money, even though the Speaker of the House is holding it up. But he'll cave, I think, in the end, because his members want that money. But it won't make any difference. What people don't understand is, I'll just give you an example. As I follow this and the reports I look at, in the last 2 to 3 weeks, the Russians have destroyed $20 billion worth of equipment we've given. They've taken out about 4 Patriot missile systems. They've taken out 3 or 4 HIMARS. They've already destroyed 5 Abrams tanks. We gave them 31, and at least 5 have been destroyed. They're just taking out all of this equipment. There's nothing we can do to stop them unless we want to send troops and go to war with Russia. That's the only thing left. And I think we've decided we're not going to. We're not going to go to war with Russia. So we're going to back off. I think the United States is slowly withdrawing. And so to finish up, the departure of Nuland is a profound symbol because the person in charge is gone. She's now a professor at Columbia University and will be opining in the New York Times and speaking. And she's being
reported. But was she forced out or did she go voluntarily?
Well, we don't know. I mean, is this somebody that's getting off the ship as it's going down or whether they were pushed out? I really don't know. There are people I respect who are more connected to the government who take both perspectives. She was pushed out or she saw the signs that were of what was coming and she chose to get out because this is going down. And she doesn't want to be in the State Department when we see Russian forces, let's say in Kiev, and Zelensky has fled the country. So I really don't know, but she's been replaced by someone who was our ambassador in Afghanistan when it collapsed. And the people that are coming into the State Department with power, the people that are in charge, are looking at China. Their focus is on Asia, on the China threat. They are not focused on Russia. I think what I'm trying to suggest is, this is my reading. I'm not in the government. I'm just watching. My reading is, we're done. Operation Ukraine has failed. The one in Georgia failed in 2008. You don't hear anything about that anymore. We tried to bring them into NATO. This one is going down. And as you may have also noticed, President Macron of France has talked about sending troops to Western Ukraine, trying to rally other European countries to do this. This would be really a very serious development. Most European countries are declining sending troops into Ukraine. President Putin has just commented on this in a very high visibility interview in Russia. As he said of Polish troops, if any Polish troops that go into Ukraine will never leave Ukraine. That's how he worded it.
What about the armed groups that we hear about from Ukraine going into Russia and staging attacks? Is that a big deal at all?
Well, it's symbolic. And of course, it gives maybe those who support the Zelensky government hope. But, you know, what happens? They cross the border and they seize a settlement. They fire on a market in Belgorod and kill 12 people. They take out a tanker ship in the Black Sea. None of this changes where this is going. These are PR stunts, the way I see it. And let me just say, in terms of what's going to happen, there is a very bad consequence, I think, for Ukraine. And the consequence is now Odessa will now be brought into Russia. They're never going to allow this to go on again. They're going to bring that in. They're going to bring Kharkov in. These are all going to be absorbed into Russia. Russia has now Crimea. They've had it for 10 years. They added 4 of the 25 provinces that were once of Ukraine, you know, in the east, the Donbass. And now we're going to see 4 more, Kharkov, Odessa, and 2 more. The Russians simply are not going to ever allow this again. So I think—
Although at first they were willing to say, you know, you can have your sovereignty, you can have it,
right,
provided it's in a neutral way and not join NATO,
right,
and we'll leave you alone. But now you're saying that they want to go much further.
Well, I mean, it's changed now. They've been in a war. They've lost 50,000 troops. 100,000 have been wounded. We're in a different— they're winning. Why would they make concessions now? It makes no sense. They're winning. And a number of their politicians have been clear. We will negotiate. We're going to negotiate surrender. Surrender means no NATO. The Zelensky government, they call them Nazis, they're nationalists, they're fascists, whatever you want to call them. they have to go, and they're going to be demilitarized, and Ukraine will be left with a military comparable to that of Switzerland. In other words, enough to sort of maintain self-respect, but not to be a threat. These are the goals. The Russians are achieving all of them. And so I think there's nothing, I mean, you're right. Unfortunately, there was an agreement in March 2022 in Istanbul that was signed by the representatives of Ukraine and Russia, and
Boris Johnson
rushed in and stopped it. So that was then, and this is now, you know. And so I think, look, the Russians are very savvy about how to appear. They want to come off like they are, shall we say, reasonable. They don't want to anger the Indians, the Brazilians, the South Africans. There are all these countries that basically support them. People don't understand this. The world is with Russia. 85% of the world is with Russia. The only countries that are with Zelensky are European, and I can't even say North American, because the Mexican president has blamed us for the war. He doesn't stand with him. No country in Latin America is embargoing or putting, I should say, sanctions on Russia other than Bermuda. No one does. So the truth of the matter is the world is not opposed to Russia. But my point is that the Russians have to appear to be conciliatory. They will sit down and negotiate. I don't think you'll ever hear them say we won't. Putin, I apparently earlier today said we're ready to negotiate. They're ready to negotiate surrender.
But the way it'll be played here is that the Russians are still the aggressors that have taken over Ukraine, and that the U.S. was weak for letting them do so. And then you have the possibility that Trump will become president, and according to Viktor Orban in Hungary, there will be no aid to Ukraine.
All right. Well, it may be there is no Ukraine by January of 2020, whatever, the next 2025. Well, I mean, I can't, you know, who knows? I mean, I think this election, I think our electoral setting is very dynamic. Who knows who's going to win? You're right. I think the opponents of what is happening there will blame the administration. But I think the logic would be they're better off to let it go now than to let it go down in October. In other words, it looks like things are disintegrating pretty quickly now. And it's very possible that for all intents and measures, this is going to be over this summer. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to predict that. A very prominent Russian general came out, and the Russian military are very careful what they say publicly. They don't overpromise. Someone came out, apparently shared this privately with some people I listened to, and it's now public. He said, listen, dramatic developments are coming between March and May from us, from the Russians. What I think that means, I'm just guessing. I think they're going to move into Kharkov, and that'll all be taken. I think they'll come down and sweep through. And so they're taking out all of these defensive systems, the HIMARS, the Patriot systems. And so, you know, they don't want to lose planes, et cetera. So I think when they decide the time is right, they've got about 750 to 800,000 troops ready to go. There's a million overall, but in terms of active. And the Ukrainian force is below 200,000. You know, this is a totally different scene. In 2022, when this started, the Russians introduced a force under 200,000. And NATO had built up a Ukrainian army of 700,000. But most of them are gone now. You know, most have been killed. Ukraine's lost 500,000 troops. Another 500,000 are wounded. All the young men are pretty much gone. The average age of, as I understand it, the average age of the Ukrainian soldiers is 44. Well, if the average age is 44, you've got 50 and 60-year-olds. They're just not up to fighting 20-year-olds. So, I mean, I think, to be honest with you, the outcome is clear. But that doesn't mean there won't be serious fighting. And I do remind people, looking back at World War II, if you look at the European theater, the United States lost more troops in April 1945 than in any month of the war, including when we went into Normandy, you know, when we scaled those heights. In April, the month that Hitler committed suicide, we lost more troops in Europe. So the fighting was fierce. It was over. Everybody knew it was over, but the Germans put up a big fight. So there may be some horrific fighting ahead. I'm just talking about realistically where this is. How do you stop them? This is the question I would ask somebody. How do you stop Russia now? What are you going to use? What weapons are left? We've given them everything other than our best. And if we're going to give them our best, then I guess we introduce our troops. I just haven't talked to any Americans that are okay with sending in troops. I ask my students, are you willing to go to Ukraine? I've never met a student who says, yes, I'll go fight the Russians.
What about this idea?
I agree with you. I do agree with you. We will blame Putin. You know, he's a monster, and they were aggressive, and we were weak. I think we invested hundreds of billions of dollars, but I never saw any will, you know, in the United States to send troops.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. If you're just joining us, KBOO's David Rosenberg is speaking with University of Arizona professor Pat Willerton about potential ending scenarios for the Russia-Ukraine war. Let's get back to it.
What about this idea that you hear from certain European leaders that if we allow Russia to take Ukraine, they're going to come for us in Lithuania and Poland and Sweden and Finland and all that?
Yeah, I never bought into the domino theory. You know, I'm a product of the Vietnam War. I was a kid then, but I remember that. I was draft age. I didn't end up serving in the war. We ended the draft before I would have gone. We heard all about that, you know, and I think anyone that's older remembers that. And in the end, North Vietnam won. They unified Vietnam. There was no expansion. They didn't go to New Zealand, Australia. They didn't come to Hawaii. We heard this kind of talk in terms of the Middle East. If we don't get them there, they'll be over here. We'll have terrorists hiding behind saguaro cacti here. Never saw any. I mean, we've gone through this so many times. Yeah, I think this boogeyman has been played one time too many. I don't find people here buying into this. I mean, now listen, I'm working with a Polish scholar on a project, and he certainly takes the view you identified. But I understand if I lived in Poland and I looked at the history of my country, Poland, with Russia, I would be worried. But I can't imagine any American looking at this can fear that the Russians are going to invade Germany or France. I mean, now, having said that, if Macron puts French troops in, I think the Russians will annihilate them. And I don't really know what the French will do. What do you do? Would France really go to war with Russia? I don't think so. So that's a different story. What you're talking about is an aggressive Russia that, having won this victory, now is going to move into other countries. I don't see it. It's a domino theory. I have to be honest with you. I'm kind of surprised anybody's talking like this. It's really a crude, old-fashioned thinking. And I thought we were mature enough as a country, having lived through this in the Vietnam War. We know better than that.
I mean, I remember even Kissinger would talk about Russia or the Soviet Union as a kind of conservative power. It wasn't really
absolutely
Nazi.
It's always
Germany ready to march on the world, you know.
Right.
Look, spheres of influence, that kind of thing.
Look, Ukraine is the most important country in the world to Russia. This is the source of their civilization. They didn't want it in NATO. They didn't want American bases and American nuclear weapons there. I don't see any difference between this and President Kennedy saying we didn't want Soviet missiles in Cuba. And we know President Kennedy was willing to go to a nuclear war over that. And the Soviets got it. They backed out. Of course, we don't have any emotional feeling about Cuba. We just didn't want the power. For Russia, Ukraine is the font of their civilization. What they see going on is horrific there now. And, you know, every Russian I know has friends or relatives in Ukraine. I think every Ukrainian has some connection to Russia. This is a truly sad, horrible situation that these two Slavic peoples are fighting each other. But here we are. Of course, Ukraine was a split country. I don't call it Ukraine versus Russia. I call it Western and Central Ukraine versus Eastern and Southern Ukraine. It was essentially a civil war. When the democratic government was removed through a coup in 2014, sponsored by the West, not only was the president removed, the parliament was purged of members from the East and the South. The Constitutional Court that weighed in and said these ousters were illegal, that it was disbanded. In other words, we always present this as there was a despotic, horrible president that was removed, French Revolution. This is a bunch of nonsense. This was a struggle within the country that was very much stirred up by outside forces. It was there. There were genuine tensions in Ukraine. And you could just look at the presidential elections, 1991 through 2010. And they were always, like in the United States, 51 to 49. And one time, the pro-Western guy would win. And he couldn't govern, and they'd throw him out, and then elect a pro-Russian one. And then 5 years later, he was gone. So the country was evenly divided. There was a lot of domestic tension. And maybe in the end, when we look back, we'll say, you know, these very counterposed regions were never going to work together in the end. Maybe Eastern Ukrainians and Western Ukrainians just are not going to work well together in one state. We'll never know, of course. But my point is that Ukraine has been divided. It was divided before all of this. And I look at this as a kind of a civil war within what used to be Ukraine. And now the Russians are in there. But of course, so are the Westerners. You know, we just had a New York Times article come out 2 weeks ago. In 2014, the CIA put in 12 bases along the front there in the east between Kiev, Ukraine, and eastern Ukraine. The West has been very involved. We've had thousands of agents, CIA, military, they're all in there. There's been a great deal of foreign involvement, not just Russia. A lot of foreign countries have been involved in what's going on there.
What about all the refugees? What is it, 14 million or more? Where are they going to go? And are they going to come back? I guess that's all speculation.
Well, assuming that the Russians achieve their goals, and what we're going to end up with much of Ukraine absorbed into Russia, the rest will form a rump state. The fact that I am guessing that Odessa will be a part of Russia means that the rump state of Ukraine will be landlocked. It will be landlocked. They're losing the most economically viable part of the country, agriculturally and in terms of industry in the east. So this is going to be a very economically problem-ridden rump state. So you've got 5 or 6 million of them are in Russia. Many of them will go back. I know somebody here who's an ethnic Russian from Ukraine living in the United States. He's going back once the Russians have secured this because he's pro-Eastern. He's from the East. He supports Russia. He will go back. So there are people like that. On the other hand, people that live in the center, let's say, of Ukraine, who are really hostile to Russia, who've left, are they going to want to go back and live in a country that's deferential to Russia, if not dominated? Probably not. So I think some will return, some will not. I'm guessing many will move here to the United States and Canada. We have big populations out of the end of the Second World War. We'll have more.
Most of the people in the East who... I'm sorry, are there people in the East who are resentful of Russia because they think the Russians have caused too much destruction? And
the feeling there is the Russians are their liberators. My friend is waiting. He's from Kharkov. His family's in Kharkov. They're waiting to be liberated. If you look at the interviews of people in Avdiivka, this recent site of tremendous fighting, there were some that stayed. They're thrilled. They welcome the Russians. They discuss what went on when the Kiev people were there. CNN, I was shocked because Western media never show this because they're inconvenient truths. I mean, I'm talking mainstream media. They actually did a report. They were interviewing people in a town that's soon to be taken by the Russians. These people were offered the opportunity to evacuate. They said, no, we don't want to go back to, we don't want to move to Ukraine. We're waiting for the Russians. I couldn't believe that CNN showed this because, as you know, the common wisdom is that people there hate Russia. No, the people in the East want the Russians to come in. And, you know, the four regions that joined Russia, of course, we don't recognize the referenda. I don't have any doubt that the people that voted what they wanted. Now, I think the people that didn't vote opposed it and didn't want to vote, but they had like 80% turnout. It was like 90-some% voted for. No, I think in those places, they identify as Russian and they feel they've been the victims of the regime in Kiev for the last 10 years. So no, I don't. That is not the view in the East. Now, I know somebody here, for instance, who apparently the family came out of Mariupol, which was the site of a horrific war, battle, and would tell you that, her family, you know, they hated the Russians and what the Russians did. But on the other hand, when you look at when the city was evacuated and when people left there because it was just left in ruins, 90% of them went east. They went to Russia. I think it was overwhelmingly pro-Russian. You know, I live in a community in Tucson, 80-20 Biden, Trump. But there's Trump people here. They would tell you we're Trump country, but they're not. It's Biden country. So, you know, in other words, in any community, there's a mix. But when you go further east, it's more pro-Russian. When you go further west, it's more anti-Russian. You go to some of the Western Ukrainian regions, you know, back before all this started, they voted 98% for the anti-Russian candidate. Absolutely anti-Russian. But this image we have that everybody there thinks that way is not true. It's not true. So it's very split. Again, the elections were always very close, always close. It's like the United States, 50-50. And you could look at a region like here. We all know how Rhode Island's going to vote this fall. We all know how Mississippi's going to vote. It's just a handful of states. I've been one of them, Arizona. We don't know. We could go either way. I think you're in California. We know how you're going to vote. So this is the way Ukraine was. People knew. But there were a few areas where people flipped. So this is the way the country was. It was very divided. to be honest with you, I don't know what you find in your community. Here, the interest has fallen. There's not much interest in Ukraine anymore. We're focused on the Israeli situation. And I think beyond the Middle East, there's more concern about China than there is about Russia. I think what's coming...
Well, that's what the conservatives in Congress want. They want to take attention away from Ukraine and focus on China, it looks like.
Well, the other thing is, what do you do? I mean, as I said, I ask you the question, and it's not a rhetorical question. I'm sincere. How are we going to stop the Russians? I see no way now. The sanctions failed. I don't understand what people thought when we tried that. Over 17,000 sanctions. Their economy is very strong. It's stronger than ours and any European country. I mean, what were they thinking? This is the most resource-rich country in the world. That was the key to all of this. They were going to be put in great economic pain, and then they'd get rid of Putin. Didn't happen. He's going to get reelected easily. He's very popular. This isn't about guns at people's heads. I know that that's what people here think. They know exactly what's going on. They're very happy with the state of the economy. They support what's going on in Ukraine. And so, you know,
there was a small peace movement in Russia, right?
Yeah.
In Ukraine.
Look at Navalny. I mean, Navalny was he was a heroic figure in our narrative for us. He's not important to Russians. Russians thought he was an eccentric, to be honest with you. He was not a threat to Putin. This is our narrative. This is our view. You have to understand, you know, there were 1,000 people showed up when he died in a metropolitan area of 18 million. So, you know, again, we live in a different reality here about Russia. And I noticed when Tucker Carlson did the interview, he spent a few days there, went around and showed things. And they showed these things like, you know, all the progress economically. And then this was all criticized as propaganda. But that's the way it is. I mean, what do you want? The country is doing well economically. Germany is careening towards a depression. All of the rest of Europe is in a recession. We are growing. The United States, but at a lower rate. I mean, this is reality. You just look at the IMF numbers, the World Bank numbers. This isn't propaganda. I think the problem here is people don't want to hear this. So I think maybe what will happen here is what happened to Afghanistan. I noticed no one talks about Afghanistan. We were there 20 years. We were committed to the status of women in Afghanistan. What happened to that? We don't talk about it anymore. I assume Ukraine will go away. It's unpleasant. It's unpleasant what happened. That's how we'll look at it.
And will the leadership talk about the Ukraine syndrome like they talked about the Vietnam syndrome as an excuse to
spend
on the military?
I just don't know. I mean, my worry now is, of course, the dynamic situation in the Middle East, which could completely go out of control. And I'm also concerned about China. China is also a serious matter. We're a powerful country, but I think we got a little accustomed to the power we had about 20 years ago. We just don't have the power that we could take on all of these regions simultaneously. And maybe in the end, that's why President Biden, who's absolutely opposed to Putin, absolutely committed to Ukraine, is allowing this to go on. Maybe in the end, they see we've run out of options unless we want to go to war. I don't think we want to go to war with Russia. They will go to war. They will go to war over this. They're very clear about it. Like President Kennedy in 1962, who was willing to go to war, Putin will go to war over Ukraine. And that's the decision we have to make. I've never met anybody who said, yes, I'm willing to risk a nuclear war.
That's University of Arizona professor Pat Willerton speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg about potential ending scenarios for the Russia-Ukraine war. You've been listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Bertie. Thanks for being with us. Thank you.
listening to KBOO Portland.
Ah, the flowers are blooming. The birds are singing.